the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and I want to welcome everyone to the weekly Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast, where we bring you every week leaders in the world of sports science. And this week is certainly no exception. We have an international guest today. We have Dr. Ross Tucker with us from South Africa. Ross got his PhD from the University of Cape Town in exercise physiology. He is currently a senior lecturer at the University of Cape Town in the Exercise Science and Sports Medicine Department, and he's also on the management of the Springbok Sevens team. Welcome, Ross. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Tim. Good to be with you.
Thank you. And I want to tell you, and I've told you this in private, but I also want to put this out, that Ross also writes probably the most detailed and extensive blog on sports science that I've ever seen. It's called the Science of Sports website. And I'm going to tell everybody, we'll put the links to that on our show notes, but I would really highly encourage you to check that out. So congratulations on that effort, Ross. That's a great read every time you put something up.
Yeah, thanks for your support. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So let's just dive into this. We mentioned that you're on the management of the Springbok Sevens. Now, most of our listeners are from North America, and so we have no clue what that is.
So Sevens is the newest Olympic sport,
okay,
which will be making its debut in the 2016 Games in Rio.
Mm.
It's a lot like rugby. I'm sure that most of the listeners have at least heard of or maybe seen a little bit of rugby, which is kind of our English version of your American football.
Okay.
Except Sevens is played, as the name suggests, with seven players per side for 7 minutes each half. So they play 7 minutes, then turn around and play another 7 minutes. And it's quick, and it's exciting, and it's a full day. And I think, you know, if it's done right, it'll be one of the most popular sports at the Olympic Games. And so people can look forward to learning a lot more about it in the future. You guys have a team, incidentally.
Do we?
You do.
Are they any good?
They aren't one of the top five.
Okay.
That's because rugby is still a new thing, I think, in America.
Yeah.
I expect that with the Olympic inclusion, the United States will become one of the stronger sides.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the big things that I'm responsible for on our end is looking at the strategic side of the sport. And as soon as that decision was announced that Sevens would become an Olympic sport, everyone started looking at what was going to happen with the likes of Australia and the United States, because these are nations that put a lot of emphasis on the Olympics, and they've got so much expertise in Olympic sports, and all of a sudden that expertise was going to be applied to Sevens.
Mm.
And so I wouldn't be exaggerating if I said that you guys give us a few sleepless nights, because we're waiting. We're waiting for you guys to get a lot better than you are now.
Well, you know, it's taken us a while in soccer, or football, as most of the rest of the world knows it. So you may not have any worries for a while.
Hopefully. But we do, because already there are patches where the USA has been very good. The problem you have is that you don't have depth, because you don't have enough numbers to choose from. So
yeah,
you kind of have to make do with what you've got. But I think it'll take maybe one generation, two generations, and then all of a sudden the depth will start, because I do think a lot of young, talented schoolboys will start saying, you know, actually, this is quite a cool sport. We can go to the Olympics for this, when we couldn't go to the Olympics as a football player, for example, or basketballer.
Right.
And I think that will start to change things from your side. So that plus the might of your Olympic Committee's resources behind Sevens equals bad news for all of us, maybe.
Well, I think probably what most of us in North America know about rugby, and especially in South Africa, we've learned from the movie Invictus.
Yep.
And which was, I enjoyed the movie greatly. So Sevens is a version of that. Is it played indoors or outdoors? Is the field the same size? Or?
It's exactly the same. The only difference, as I say, is the number of players per team.
Yeah.
And the length of the game is significantly shorter. So there's a lot more space on the field, which is what makes it so entertaining, because give good players more space and they can run more, and there's more openness, more passing, more excitement. Because 15 rugby, the World Cup actually for 15s is on the go at the moment in New Zealand.
Mm.
You guys also have a team there, incidentally. And that's a lot tighter. It's a lot more constrained by the number of players. There's not space. It's a bit more attritional, where Sevens is a lot more open because the field's the same size. Everything's the same.
Wow. Well, we look forward to that. It sounds like a fun, fast-paced game, and I would think it would really tax their endurance.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I've worked with that team, and I honestly feel that of any sports athletes that I've ever seen, the complete package is there, the speed, power, agility, coordination, endurance, obviously, because they play three matches a day. Even though each game is only 14 or 15 minutes long, the ability to recover from one day, one game to the next, one day to the next is a paramount importance. So I think that in terms of overall conditioning and athletic ability, world-class sevens players are right at the top of any athlete or any sport.
Interesting. Well, we will certainly look forward to seeing that. Are these matches put on the web? Can people, if they're interested, go and check these out on the web someplace?
It's heading that way. I know that Universal Sports show them, so I would imagine that they show them also online.
Okay.
And there's a tournament in Las Vegas in February every year. It's normally over that Valentine's weekend.
Okay.
Second Saturday, Sunday of Feb. And last year was televised live on your television, I think NBC. And I think it was the largest viewership ever for sevens. So it is definitely on the way up.
Wow.
And I can't see them stopping that. So definitely people will see it next year.
Okay, we'll see if we can find some links and throw some links up in our show notes.
Perfect.
Yeah, let's, I guess, shift a bit, and maybe this also plays into sevens, and that's you've done a lot of work with pacing. You've also talked a lot on an international basis about pacing strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell our audience what pacing is and what are the newest kind of things in that?
Pacing is a blindingly obvious concept to anyone who's ever done any kind of running, cycling, or swimming. And that's because we know that if we don't do it right, we blow up and we just can't finish an exercise trial. So anyone, whether they're a world-class athlete, a Tour de France cyclist, or someone who's doing a 5-kilometer fun run just socially, knows that if you don't start at the right speed, then you end up paying for it later on. And that's the essence of pacing. So it's defined as how we allocate our energy resources and our physiological resources to an exercise trial, because we know that this is 10 kilometers or 20 minutes or 500 meters or whatever the case is, and we know that we have to now distribute our energy equally across the entire trial in order to optimize performance. And if we fail to do it, as I say, then there's a cost to pay. And that's the basics of what pacing is. Now, there are obviously many physiological implications of trying to study that, because the question is, how do we know to slow down? And why do we slow down more on a hot day than on a cold day? And how does altitude affect it? And how would perhaps certain drugs affect our pacing and so forth? And that's the question that I did most of my PhD on, and is the sort of fundamental aspect of this whole regulation of exercise by the brain.
It's kind of difficult for folks to regulate their pacing, especially recreational athletes. I know that from my own standpoint, when I've run in races and so forth, I'm usually so jacked up at the beginning that when I get started, it is like you want to go out and, you know, run super splits, and then you really pay for it. So how do these athletes, how do they get on a pace, and how do they stay on that pace?
Yeah, so what you're talking about now is an extremely important part of it, and that's it's the psychological and the emotional aspects of pacing. And that's why when you're in a race, when there are 20,000 people screaming at you to go faster, you're far more likely to make mistakes by going too quickly early on, which you then pay for later on. And that's an area that was neglected for a long time, I think, in exercise science, was trying to understand the psychology and the affect and the emotional aspects of performance regulation. But I think what happens is, elite athletes, when they're well-trained, in fact, not even elite athletes, any well-trained athlete has learned how to respond to signals from the body so accurately that they can override that emotional response to go too quickly. So the model that we propose then basically consists of inputs before you start exercise and constant feedback during exercise from infinite number of physiological systems and how they interact with one another. So, for example, your anticipation of exercise duration, your level of motivation, levels of fatigue before exercise, all these are present before you start. Then the gun goes off, and immediately feedback starts coming in. How hot is it today? How much energy do I have? How much oxygen is available? And it's the calculation that is made by the brain which assimilates all these different factors, which allows athletes to pace themselves. And the best athletes, the most highly trained ones, are the ones, I think, who are most sensitive to those signals, and obviously then are able to regulate pacing more accurately than a novice or an untrained athlete would be.
Now, in the old days, I know that there were, they called them rabbits, used in races that would help people set certain paces. I think, but Roger Bannister use rabbits in breaking the 4-minute mile the first time? Is that still used, that kind of strategy still used?
Yeah, they do. Every big meeting in Europe these days, other than the world champs and the Olympics, employs these paces or rabbits to go out and do the work for someone else. And I think that helps because we know that if you're able to follow someone, whether it's the emotional aspect of it, there's obviously certain wind resistance issues also that are in play, however small they may be. But I think being able to follow someone who then steps aside for you at the end of the race to allow you to go through and finish fast is definitely helpful. I think it just takes off the psychological and the intellectual pressure of having to set the pace for yourself.
Interesting stuff. That happens also in swimming and biking and a variety of other sports as well.
Yeah, anything. And the reason it happens is because, well, there's two things. One is to optimize performance. Now, we know that if you're running a marathon, you can't go out as if you're running a 10-kilometer race and try and hang on, because in the end, the physiology will win.
Yeah, that doesn't work. I've tried that before.
Yeah. By accident or by design, most people will have done that.
Right.
And you know that the physiology always wins. And so, people often talk about mind over matter.
Yeah, right.
With respect to psychologists, I'm not a psychologist, but for me, it's brain matter over body matter. There's no mind over matter. It's like you can't commit suicide by holding your breath.
Right.
Because the body will always win, and it's the same in exercises. You can't override what your brain is allowing you to do, but the key is that any time that there's exercise causing physiological changes, your body has to try and regulate those physiological changes and, importantly, optimize performance.
Yeah.
And it's the two requirements there that are sometimes in conflict with one another, but usually not. And so usually if you want to run the best possible marathon, the best possible 100-meter swimming trial, there's a specific pacing strategy that you have to learn in order to allocate what you have physiologically as optimally as possible.
Well, how do they learn that? Just by experience and in training?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because obviously what you're asking someone to do in order to achieve a maximal performance is to get as close to that point of, call it failure, as you can. And I think with time you learn where that line exists. You learn how hard you can go before you have to slow down. And there's no question that there's a reserve when we exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this reserve because even the fastest athlete in the world in the marathon or the 10,000 speeds up at the end.
Mm.
Now, the fact of the matter is that they start fast and then they get slow in the middle laps and then they accelerate and they speed up at the end. And the fact that you can speed up at the end is an indication that there has to be some kind of skeletal muscle reserve there.
Mm-hmm.
The question you should be asking is, well, if it's there at the end, why did he not access it in the middle?
Right.
And I think with training, you learn how to get closer and closer and closer so that the best athletes have less reserve when they cross the finish line than you or I may have.
Now, you had recently in your blog, you've been doing some really pre-detailed analysis of 800-meter split times from the World Championships, and we'll talk about the context in which that's done. But one of the things that's interesting you talked about, if I recall correctly, is that people do not run negative splits at the world level. In other words, their last half of the race is not as fast as the first half?
Of course, they can run negative splits. It's possible for an elite runner to go out very slowly and then pick up the pace in the second lap.
Right.
But then that's not an optimal performance. And so when you look at the best possible performance, and you know, people may say that this is something of a circular argument, and I certainly accept that, but the best possible result will come from running the first lap about 3 to 4% faster than the second lap. And that's not necessarily only true in 800 meters. That's true in a 200 meters, 400 meters, 800,
mm-hmm.
and it's also true in cycling events that last less than 2 minutes. Is that the best result seems to come from starting as fast as possible and then allowing yourself to slow down so that you don't ever have a reserve, but you basically have to cash in while the going is good. And it seems that in those events, the going is good at the beginning.
Right.
As soon as you get longer, like 1,500 meters or 5 minutes and upward, then your better strategy is even paced with an increase in speed at the end.
Hmm. Very interesting. And I bring this up in context as a way to move us to a conversation that you've been involved with on the international level, and that is Oscar Pistorius, who is the double amputee that is striving to run at the Olympics next year. He's he filed suit to run in the World Championships. There was quite a legal mess about the scientific evidence that suggested that he had an advantage over the able-bodied runners. And I wanted to really highlight for our audience the whole series that you've done on that. What would be the take-home message from all of that? Does he have an advantage by running with these carbon fiber blades?
Yeah, this is the most controversial topic I think that I've ever written anything about or had a comment on. So people get super riled up about it. I think it's such an emotive concept because he's very clearly an inspirational person.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone who a lot of people find inspirational, and that's understandable because he's overcome so much in order to achieve what he has.
Right.
But the scientific issue is quite different, and there one has to look at all the evidence. And there are three separate areas of evidence. The first is a series of studies that was done on him by the IAAF, the International Athletics Federation, in 2007 when he first wanted to run. The second was done in Texas by a team of scientists who Pistorius got together. And the third was a paper that was brought out by two of those scientists who had tested him in Texas and then had a disagreement or a change of opinion at some point with his other scientific members of his scientific team.
Mm-hmm.
And my interpretation is that across all three of those studies, there is no doubt that there is an advantage, because the way that science works, and the listeners will appreciate this, is that you have enough insight and understanding to formulate a hypothesis. And so you're looking at these carbon fiber blades and you say, well, the energy return from carbon fiber is significantly higher than the energy return from tendon. That's point one. Secondly, is that those carbon fiber blades are significantly lighter than able-bodied limbs are, and so therefore you can accelerate the lighter mass much more quickly, and that would be an advantage for sprinting, which is all about how quickly you can move your limbs.
Yeah.
And the third point is that carbon fiber doesn't get tired over the course of a 45-second race,
right,
whereas human muscle and tendon does, and there's lots of evidence for this. So those three factors together allow one to make the hypothesis that says that at any running speed, Pistorius will use less energy than able-bodied runners, and he will use less oxygen than able-bodied runners, and his running mechanics will be completely different to anything that is measured in able-bodied runners.
Right.
And so that's the hypothesis. And then what science is testing the hypothesis, and that's what was done. And in every single case, they confirmed exactly those hypotheses. And the end result was that two of his own scientists did a calculation where they predicted that the advantage to him was enormous. Now, I think they made some errors in some of the assumptions that they made, but the fact remains that he has lower physiological energy costs, much lower oxygen costs of running, and such different mechanics that his ability to swing his limbs is faster than even the fastest 100-meter runners ever measured in that laboratory. And he's, in the words of one of his scientists, he's off the biological charts. And so for me, everything points to an advantage because it confirms the hypothesis. And it's taking the science in context, coming up with a hypothesis, and interpreting the results, and all the roads kind of lead to the same point.
For the audience that's listening, what's fascinating to this about for me is, and you heard Ross very clearly reiterate the point he's made in writing, and I would agree with, is that Oscar Pistorius has overcome so many challenges, and he is an inspirational figure. But the scientific fact does remain that he has an advantage over the able-bodied sprinters. I think that I agree that I don't think he should be allowed to compete with them because of the advantage he has, and especially those three areas. And
yeah.
The further point from this, I have been amazed at the personal attacks that have been made on you for just stating what is scientifically obvious.
I'm not amazed by them anymore, but I was at the beginning. It's incredible. People get so riled up and personal about it, and they rather shoot the messenger than listen to what you have to say.
Right.
But that's how people are, you know, and I can understand that. But I, as I say, like for the scientific reasons, and because I'm coming at it from the point of view of the sport, I believe the same thing that you've just said, is that he should be running Paralympic competitions and not Olympic Games or World Championships. I can understand in a more sort of reflective moment that because he's unique, there's not exactly 50 runners out there like him, and because at the moment he's not winning gold medals by 10 meters in these races, and because he adds so much value in terms of his inspirational qualities, I would understand why some people would argue that he should be allowed to run anyway.
Right.
I don't agree with him, but I can understand why they would have that opinion. But what I can't agree with is a person who says, well, he doesn't have an advantage and then he should run. To me, it's either a question of let him run even though he has an advantage, or don't let him run because he has an advantage. But don't say that there's no advantage, because to me it's pretty clear that there is.
Right. And we don't allow other athletes to have other kinds of advantages. You know, we don't allow them to take steroids and so forth, so why should this exception be made? So
exactly.
This is a mechanical. This may be a mechanical advantage. It's not a pharmaceutical advantage, but still, it's still an advantage.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah.
So let's talk about a lot of your analysis that you've done. You've done through your blog on Science of Sports, which I have recommended already, and I will continue to recommend for its detailed analysis. I frankly don't know how you turn out this analysis so quickly. When did you start this, and why did you decide that this was important to do?
In 2007, I'd finished my PhD in 2006.
Hmm.
And at the same time as I did my PhD, I did a postgraduate from the university's commerce faculty so that I could get into a little bit of marketing and management and business side of things, because I wouldn't go so far as to call it a midlife crisis, but I did at that point when I was wrapping up my academic PhD, I started to think, actually, you know what, if I really want to make an impact, I have to learn a little bit about how to be worldly about my science, if that makes any sense. So in 2007, having learned quite a lot about the internet and about business strategy, I thought, you know, it would be quite a cool idea to start a website which would act as a way to get coaching information out. And I had a friend of mine who graduated at the same time as me, Jonathan Dugas, who then moved to Chicago, and he and I spoke about it, and he was very interested in cycling. I was very interested in running, and we said, let's start a website, and the purpose is we will coach athletes on the internet. And so we did this. We created, you know, it's free now, it's easy, anyone can have a blog.
Yeah.
And literally overnight, I woke up the next morning, and I thought, you know, this is a crazy idea, because there are 555,000 websites like ours,
right,
who are giving coaching information. And how are we going to be distinctive? And I thought the way to be distinctive is to do something that I've always been frustrated that I haven't been able to find, and that's insight into sport. Because, you know, when it comes to politics, you can read Time magazine or Newsweek or The Economist, whatever it is, and you can read second, third, fourth level about what's happening. Whereas in sport, the only thing you can do is you can read in the newspaper what happened. You never get people who try and explain to you why it happened, how it happened, the hidden side of sport, so to speak. And that was something that fascinated me. So I thought, well, let's set up a website that tries to give informed insight and opinion on sports news and see whether that takes off. And as it turned out, coincidentally, the first big story that we covered was Oscar Pistorius, because it was in mid-2007 that he became a household name. And so we said, well, okay, let's look at Oscar Pistorius and let's actually present to people the science behind this.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there was a market there and it seemed like people were interested, so we just kept going.
Good timing, huh?
It worked out well in the end, yeah. And we've been lucky in a sense, because every few months there's something big happens. You know, it was Oscar Pistorius, and then in 2008 there was a doping case in cycling. And then there was, of course, Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps in the Olympic Games. And then came Caster Semenya, and then it was... So there's always something there, and people can pick up a magazine and a newspaper and they can read about it, but no one's really going in-depth and peeling away the surface and asking what's underneath, and that's what we try to do.
Well, you do a great job, and I also want to cue the listeners in that you've also done a whole series on barefoot running. We've just recently had Dan Lieberman up on the podcast talking about barefoot running as well. And so if you were interested in that topic, you can certainly go to the Science of Sports website and look at a whole bunch of information that Ross and his colleagues have put up there as well on barefoot running. So are you doing barefoot running yet?
I'm actually, you mean myself?
Yeah.
I am. I've just had a few injury concerns and I'm starting to come back. And I figured this is the best opportunity I'll get to do it barefoot.
Mm.
Because one of the big issues with barefoot running, I think, is if you take a guy who's doing 40, 50 miles a week in shoes, and you try and go barefoot, he's going to get very frustrated very quickly, and he's going to overdo it and get injured. Because I think there's quite a long transition that needs to happen. So I figured that because I'm injured and I'm doing 0 miles a week, now's as good a time as any to start. And I'm also doing, I've just started a research project on barefoot running, because I'm really fascinated by how people learn to run barefoot. Because what Daniel Lieberman, who you just spoke about, showed is that when you take someone who's always run in shoes and you make them run barefoot, the very first time they run, it's actually very bad. Their impact forces are very high, and their rate of loading is also very high. And over time, that has to come back down. And we want to study how people learn to run barefoot again. And so we are going to start that hopefully early next year and do a little eight-week study where we measure the biomechanics once every couple of weeks and see if we can figure out what happens as people learn.
Fascinating. Well, that means that we've got to have you back on the podcast so you can tell us what happened.
Yeah, anytime.
There you go. We're running out of time here, Ross. So we always give our guests an opportunity to give us a take-home message for our audience. So what would your take-home message be?
For me, the most important thing is to deliberately find ways to fail. And by that, what I mean is, in anything, whether it's in science or in business, you have to be prepared to challenge things, which inevitably means that you won't succeed at first.
Right.
And so if you're not failing, it means you're not trying hard enough.
Right.
And so go out there and figure out ways to challenge the existing boundaries, challenge knowledge, challenge convention. And you will fail, and you will stumble, and you will meet with a lot of resistance, but just keep going, learn from every single occasion that you fail, and eventually you'll emerge understanding more, knowing more, having achieved more. So embrace failure rather than avoid it.
And you know, it's a great philosophy. I think people have become too safe. They don't want to fail whatever reason, and they don't learn anything. They don't grow, as you said. And
yeah,
I think
they just stand in one place.
Yeah, it's a great take-home message.
Cool, yeah, I'm glad.
Thanks for reminding us of that. I want to thank all of you that have been listening for taking the time to download us. We ask and we hope that you join us next week for our next episode. And don't think that we've forgotten about our free T-shirt question. Justin, you have that question for us?
So what's the difference between traditional rugby and sevens?
Okay, and so be the first one to email us with the answer to that question, and you'll win a free Huffines podcast T-shirt. And they're pretty nifty, so make sure you email us soon. Thanks again, Ross, for being with us. We look forward to talking to you in the future and seeing more
from you. Yeah, no worries, and it's been a pleasure to chat. Thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome. And again, thank you all for being with us, and we hope between now and next week when you tune us in again that you'll have an active and healthy week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.